Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. Stay tuned for tonight's special report on destroyed arguments, destroyed legal arguments, when we come back. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor, and we're taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if a plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? Or what if a carpenter said, he who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client? Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or steps is incompetent? You know, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself in court has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or carpenter. Now, listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor of law at the Hastings Law School when he said, quote, "It is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed." He said it's worse than that. Most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and for their clients, that it is a cruel hoax, unquote. That's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you just call the law school at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. That number again, 417-273-4967. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure, our school is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send an email request for that free general law CD package. I want you to do it right now before you forget. Remember, georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Larry B. Graff some years ago put out an article on his website called Destroyed Arguments. In this treatise, about 30 pages long, you could probably download it from his website, he outlined about 20 or 30 of the most common arguments that are used by patriots in the judicial process that have already been adjudicated and lost. Now, it doesn't make any sense to take an argument that has already been ruled on and ruled adversely upon and then take it into court and use that as your defense. It's being done constantly by patriots coast to coast and border to border, and Larry B. Graff took the time to prove the negative. Now, that's a tough road to hoe when you go out here and prove a negative. You know, people will call me here at the law school and they'll say, prove to me that the Social Security number is the license that volunteers me into the income tax. Well, I could do that, but it takes a lot of time, effort, and energy to do that. Time, effort, and energy that I just don't want to spend trying to prove those kinds of negatives. Now, when you go to law school, you come in here and we show you the cases, and you can read the cases for yourself. And then you can arrive at a conclusion based upon what the courts and the judges tell you. That takes a few hours of time. People call me on the telephone and they want me to tell them in about 60-second sound bites like they get on television watching a Sonic ad on the TV. And they want to be entertained at the same time they're being informed. And I don't have the time, effort, or energy to do that. And Larry B. Graff evidently does because he took the time to prove all these negatives here. I'd say that's a hell of a job. And I thought I'd share that with you because now that he has taken the hours and hours and hours of time to research out these cases, to prove these points, it's easy for me to come along and just reiterate and say, well, here's the case. There it is. You can go read it for yourself. That issue was brought up and lost. Here's the case. Here's the citation for it. Go read it for yourself. So while I can do it for myself, or if there's money involved, I don't mind taking the time to go do it, but I don't want to sit here and be put on the spot oftentimes by people that are too damn lazy to go do their own legal research. So they want to call me and challenge me, say, you can't tell me, you can't prove that. And I can tell you and I can prove it, but I'm not going to take the time to do it. Now, Larry says the purpose of this file is simply educational. I've noticed too many innocents who today believe certain legal arguments popular years ago, but which were litigated by ill-prepared, desperate people and lost. To continue going down such dead-end roads and to follow these dead-end arguments will only result in disaster in those cases. But I don't want you to think that by posting this information, I believe that all is lost and that there are no legal issues or important legal issues left. And he says, to the contrary, I have a very long list of solid legal issues which need to be litigated, and these are issues which will further our cause. For example, even though I post below the losses regarding my favorite issue, the money issue, there are some good issues left, but they will be raised only in the best of circumstances and the best of cases. Some of these other issues are explained on my webpage, but I am protecting these remaining issues from destruction by these desperate people who grab an issue and throw it into court. These folks have no plans nor skills to engage in the legal battle, and they slaughter our good issues. I couldn't agree more. When a person is being prosecuted for tax evasion or willful failure to file, he immediately needs a defense. And my observation, my experience has shown me that many people get involved in the tax protest movement and they have no legal training whatsoever. They just quit filing their tax returns. Some group comes along, like the Pilot Connection or some other group of this or that tax protesters, and they come up with some real good arguments. Well, they're real good arguments for lay people. Now, when I hear these arguments, like Larry Beecraft here, we kind of shake our heads and wonder, has this guy lost his marbles? Doesn't he know that that's already been settled, that it's well settled in law? First time I met Beecraft, I'll give you a little background here, was out in Colorado, near Boulder, Colorado, and we were out there working for a company called the Primrose Gazette. It was a newspaper for farmers, a farm paper, run by a fellow named Rick Elliott. Now, Rick Elliott was a con man. Later, he was prosecuted and jailed for all of the money that he stole, but Larry and I, when we were called out there, we didn't have any idea that this guy was a con man. I was very interested in farm foreclosures at this period of time in the early 1980s, say from 1980 to 85, and so was Beecraft. I was operating a school in Boise, Idaho, and Larry was an attorney down in, I think it's Huntsville, Alabama, where he lives. Huntsville, I believe, is his hometown. And so I was hired, and as was Beecraft, and we went out there, and Elliot gave us an office, and we had two desks facing each other. And a man came in, he was a farmer, and I interviewed him. He had a farm foreclosure problem, and our job was to help these farmers put together a logical defense to prevent the banks or the PCAs and land banks, et cetera, from foreclosing on their property. And I listened to this guy, and this fellow, Elliot, had a little bit of credential. Elliot had actually won a case under Title 15 Regulation Z, dealing with truth and lending with Beneficial Finance Company. And he had written up a number of lawsuits for these farmers, and he couldn't write them fast enough, so he wanted to hire Beecraft and Gordon to come out there and help him with this project. So we being zealots for our cause, went out there to do that. And then I read this complaint for this farmer. He had 320 acres, and he had sued for, get this number down now, boys and girls, $2 billion, that's B like a boy, billion dollars. It sued the bank. Now, he named as parties to this action the governor of Colorado and a whole host and plethora of other lesser elected officials, you know, like the lieutenant governor and the secretary of state and the secretary of agriculture, and I don't know how many other people. And he sued anybody that wiggled, moved, or squirmed, including the janitor and the charwoman, for $2 billion. And so during the interview, I said to this farmer, I said, how big is your farm? And he said, 320 acres. And I said, well, how much machinery and equipment do you have? And he said he had about $30,000 worth of machinery and equipment. I said, what do you grow on this farm? And he said, dryland wheat. Now, 320 acres of dryland wheat in Colorado's highlands and $30,000 worth of equipment doesn't exactly qualify you for a $2 billion lawsuit. In fact, this is before the Hazlitt rule on punitive damages, and so the most you could sue for on punitive damages was an equal amount to the actual damages. Punitive damages would not surpass the actual damages. And so unless this guy had a pool of oil worth $2 billion under this farm, you can't sue for more than the actual damages that you have suffered. So the first olive out of this farmer's jar had to be, he had to come into court and prove that he lost $2 billion as a result of this foreclosure. So the first olive out of the jar that I had to solve this problem was the amount of damages. And I could see that this farmer didn't have a clue as to damages, and neither did Rick Elliott. Well, on the other side of the table, Larry Beecraft was interviewing a farmer, and he too was suing for, I don't know, $1 billion or $2 billion or $5 billion or something. I forgot the exact amount now, but it was in the billions of dollars also. Remember, not millions. Not three or four or 500,000, which is probably more in line with what this case might have been worth. But it was in the B for billions of dollars. And these are what are known as frivolous lawsuits, and they are dismissed out of hand because they're frivolous on their face. Just the amount of the damages makes it frivolous, and so these cases get thrown out by the court. And then patriots and citizens, they say there's no justice in America. Well, there's no justice in America if you can't follow the rules. Now, you could argue that the rules are wrong and that these rules ought to be changed, but ladies and gentlemen, George Gordon does not make the rules. I don't sit in the seats of power in this country. I'm not a judge that makes rules or opinions or writes opinions. I don't sit in the legislature or the Congress and the Judiciary Committee and set down the rules of procedure. I just got here in 1939 and I follow the rules that somebody else laid down. It's kind of like playing a board game, you know, like Monopoly. I don't make the rules to Monopoly. I don't determine what a hotel on Boardwalk is worth when you land on my Boardwalk. I don't decide that. That's already been decided long before I ever picked up the dice and threw them or started playing the game. And ladies and gentlemen, that's the way the game of law is played. The rules are set down, and then a young man goes to college, he comes out with a law degree, and he goes into court, and he has to play this game by the rules. And whether you're a farmer or a businessman or whether you're a lumberjack or a carpenter, plumber, electrician, you have to play the game by the rules. Now, maybe the rent on Boardwalk is excessive and ought to be lowered. But you're going to have to call somebody else in to do that because as just a mere player in the game, I don't have the power to change those rules. And neither does a lawyer, and neither does a judge, and neither does a legislature. The legislature does its thing from its individual members, and they take their vote and they change the rules or they make the rules. Judges follow those rules, and sometimes they write opinions that can alter those rules or implement those rules. Lawyers come along and follow those rules. So when I say that this case was frivolous on its face, and after these two farmers had left, Beecraft looked over at me, and he had this kind of strange look on his face, like, I can't believe what I just heard. And so I said, how much was that lawsuit for? And he said, I think the number was about $5 billion. And I said to Beecraft, I said, well, does he have diamonds on that place, or is it oil, or what is it that makes these farms so valuable? And he said, well, how much was yours? And I said, $2 billion. And we just looked at each other with this knowing look like these cases are just frivolous. They're just nonsense. Now, that's where I first met Larry Beecraft, and I knew right away. Now, I haven't been to law school, and I'm not a lawyer. I'm a law school teacher. I want to point out that I think it's 60% or 80%, I've forgotten us. 60% of law school professors are not lawyers. So I just want to caution all of you people that just because I'm not a lawyer doesn't mean that I don't know a little something about law. I don't claim to know everything. I just claim to tell you that I'm a teacher. I don't practice law. I don't practice law for other people. I do for myself. I'm a pro se litigant, and I teach pro se litigation. And Larry Beecraft's a little different. He's been to law school, and he goes out here and he works for people. That's the way he makes his living. So I make my living teaching, and he makes his living practicing. But both of us recognized immediately the frivolity of these cases, and that's where I met him back in the 1980s. I've known Larry Beecraft for about 25 years. Pretty competent lawyer, pretty competent fellow. So when I give you this information here, I want to tell you that I'm going to put my personal stamp on this, although I have not personally looked up all these cases in here. If Larry Beecraft said that that's the way it is, then I think you can just about bank on that. And you can take that to the bank, and you can deposit that. These arguments, and I've read all of them, I know that they're frivolous arguments, and he knows that they're frivolous arguments, but when you go to your local patriot meeting, and you've been following this patriot leader over here, and when I tell you that this is frivolous, you're going to say, oh, that's just that Gordon's opinion, he's stupid anyway. So I wanted to share with you here for 5 or 10 minutes and tell you that, no, it's not just my opinion, it's Larry Beecraft's opinion, and Beecraft is a defense attorney who practices nationwide and practices in federal court, not just in the state of Alabama, but he practices in federal court. Now, he's been reprimanded a time or two. I don't want you to hold that against him. He's a pretty vigilant advocate for his side. And one time he went into court and he was trying to argue a defensive position, and the courts got kind of mad at him and said, you know, that's already been litigated, and we're gonna sanction you. That happens once in a while. I've done a few cases that I lost and wished I hadn't taken them on because I hadn't thought them out very well. And that, you know, sometimes we have these lapses of judgment. So I've had people tell me, yeah, but that Beecraft, he's the guy that was sanctioned by the court. Yeah. You get sanctioned if you're a good lawyer and you go out there and you raise hell and you work for your defendant. If you never get sanctioned, that means that you've never pushed the envelope. That's what that boils down to. If you push the envelope, you may get locked up for contempt. I've had that happen to me a couple of times. And if you push the envelope and you're a lawyer, you may get the sanctions put on you. So, yeah, I'm an envelope pusher, and Beecraft is an envelope pusher, and we're pretty good at researching and getting the facts and figures. And the reason that I'm going to take the time here to run over these destroyed arguments with you is that he took the time to research them out. I wouldn't have taken this amount of time. I would say that if he doesn't have 100 hours involved in this paper over here, he must have had a lot of help. I don't think I could have done this in 100 hours. He's got 30 arguments, a 30-page brief, in which he has taken on some of the top issues in the tax protest movement. So listen to number one and see what you think of this. It's called the money issue. Now, back in the 1970s and early 80s, advocates of the specie provisions in Article 1, Section 10 of the U.S. Constitution made a concerted effort to educate people about this controversial provision. And consequently, people, mostly those who were desperate and ill-prepared, and pro se litigants, began litigating this Article 1, Section 10 issue in defense of their income tax charges. Now, the courts have rendered the following adverse opinions on this issue. Now, the adverse opinions, I'm not going to go through here and cite all these because most of you people couldn't get this down anyway. There are 22 federal adverse decisions on the money issue and 26 state decisions. Again, you can go to Larry Becraft. Let me see if I can get you the website here. It's spelled funny. Becraft has a strange website. Let's see here if I can read it. It says http://flyhighway.net. So you go FLY.HIWAAY. There's two A's in there, .net. http://flyhighway.net. I guess after HTTP, there's two slashes. I don't know if that's important or not, but you just look up Larry Becraft on Google, and I'm pretty sure that they'll give you the site. I'm pretty sure you can still get this. It's been on there. This is dated 4/13/2000, so it's been on there for 5 years. It's just as valuable today as it was 5 years ago, or 10 years, or 15 years ago, because some of these arguments that are being used today were used 15, 20 years ago, like the Fifth Amendment defense, which actually has some merit. The Fifth Amendment defense has some merit, but not the way most patriots use it. It's just a dead-end, dead argument, a destroyed argument. But I'll explain that when we get to that Fifth Amendment a little later on. I'll give you a couple of examples of here's how it works, and here's a guy that actually used it and won, and then it's called the Garner defense, and then here's all these other people over here that have lost. But on the money issue, that is Article 1, Section 10, when you come into court on a tax issue and you raise, no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. There are 22 federal cases and 26 state cases that have shut that argument down. Not that the money issue isn't important and not that it doesn't have merit, but it's not the way these people are using it. And with the income tax, you people all have social security numbers and you volunteered into the system, and the income tax is voluntary, and you volunteered when you got that social security number. And in 1964, Congress made your social security number your taxpayer ID number. So you're a taxpayer. Now the question is, well, how much tax do you? And you say, well, I don't owe any tax. It's like a soldier, you know, joins the army, gets over to Iraq and says, well, I'm a conscientious objector. Conscientious objector is not the argument to be using once you're in Iraq, a member of the army. Conscientious objector is the argument you use before you get drafted or before you join up. Now, I wish, Larry Becraft says, I wish to ultimately win this issue. And I hear Larry loud and clear. There's an issue that I've never been able to win either. It's the driver's license issue. Now, I've won a lot of dismissals and I've won a lot of tactical battles, but the main issue itself, which is the right to travel under Crandall, is, you know, I've never been able to crack that net. I've gotten it into the U.S. Supreme Court three times and they won't hear me. I can qualify it, but they're sitting up there saying, well, we're not going to listen to you, Gordon. So that's the dead end that you run into. And Larry Becraft probably would like to go to the U.S. Supreme Court someday and argue the money issue, along with Edwin Vieira. But he says to do so will require experienced legal scholar, that's probably Edwin Vieira, who knows what they're doing. And the only person in America who should be in charge of money issue litigation is Dr. Edwin Vieira. See one of his articles posted to my main page. One of the goals of the Wallace Institute is to raise sufficient funds to turn Dr. Vieira loose to litigate this issue and win. Now, the second article that he brings up over here is called The IRS is a Delaware Corporation. I remember that back in about 1985 or so, somebody came to me and they said, did you know that the IRS is a Delaware Corporation? And I said, no, I didn't know that. And this guy said, well, yeah, it is. And so I went down and I started looking around, and sure enough, there is an IRS, Delaware Corporation. But it's out of business now, and it was incorporated back in the 1930s, as I recall. I kind of forget the details now. But it wasn't the IRS that we know as the tax collection agency of the Treasury Department. It was the IRS, a private corporation, which was incorporated in Delaware. So the guy wasn't lying. He said, did you know that the IRS was incorporated in Delaware? And I didn't know that. And I looked it up, and sure enough, I found that out. Well, many people went into court and said, well, the IRS is not a federal organization. It's a Delaware corporation, and they don't have any power to sue or be sued in this court, and blah, 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 or whatever their basic argument was. And I don't know of anybody that ever won. Everybody lost, and everybody went to prison. So Larry Becraft has this to say. He says, back in 1982 or 83, somebody started circulating the argument that the IRS was a private corporation which had been created in Delaware in 1933. If it was created only in 1933, then why do we have the following appropriations for this agency found in acts of Congress a decade before 1933? And so Larry cites 42 Statute 375, dated February 17th, 1922,
42 Statute 454, dated March 20th, 1922, 1923, 1924, 1925. I mean, he searched this out, and the IRS was being funded by Congress back in the 1920s. You know, the agency that tries to collect the money from you. So the argument that you walk into court and you say, well, my defense is, you know, and you've been charged now with tax evasion, you say, well, my defense is the IRS is not a government agency, it's a Delaware corporation. You know where that's going to take you? To prison. That's all. It's going to get you locked up. So you can forget that argument, and you can forget arguing Article 1, Section 10 in defense of your income tax non-payment or non-filing. Okay? The third item over here, he said, this is indeed a frivolous argument and has properly been rejected by the court. See Young versus IRS, 596 Fed Supplement, 1984. The real issue is whether the IRS has been created by law. Now, there might be an issue. Has the IRS been properly created by Congress, which raises a legal issue? So whenever you go into court, you have two issues to argue. Two issues. And in common law pleadings by Shipley and Koffler-Reppe and Shipley, they point out that whenever you have an allegation brought against you, a charge brought against you, it raises the issue, is this a legal or a factual defense? Is it legal or factual? Now, when the government comes up and says you haven't filed your tax returns, that's a factual allegation. But if you're a citizen of Argentina and you're charged in a U.S. court, do you have any duty to file a tax return in the United States? So there's a legal issue, that is, do I have a duty to file? And there's a factual issue, did you or did you not file? And, of course, that's what pleadings are all about. And the issue to be raised as a matter of law, which is what Larry is raising right here, is that the proper question is the legal issue, has it been created by law? I don't know. I haven't researched it out, I can tell you. Evidently, there might be some issue in Beecraft's mind. All right, we'll take up number three here, the IMF argument, the International Monetary. What do they call that? The IMF, International Monetary Fund, I believe it is. I got to give you a reminder here and a couple of disclaimers. You're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. And the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It's open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through our website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, economics, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. And remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the law school and ask for it. It's 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to the authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not necessarily mean that the authors or the publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. What that means is that when I recommend somebody or some book, they may say, you know, that guy Gordon is the dumbest dodo God ever put breath into, and I wish he wouldn't put his name on the air with ours. So when I say, no, I think that this guy over here is a pretty good guy, or I think this guy over here wrote a pretty good article and I'm going to recommend it, that doesn't mean that he's going to recommend me. Now, most of the authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, or they're religious, or they're economic, or sectarian, or racial, or ethnic partisans, whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. So when I recommend somebody, or recommend some book or periodical, I don't want you to think that I subscribe to their political, religious, or philosophical views. I may or may not. Oftentimes people will write me emails and they will say, I can't believe that you would recommend Bill Clinton's book or this or that. I don't know, hell, the Pope might write something that I agree with. And if he does, I might recommend that you read this as written by the Pope. And he'd say, well, what are you, one of them damn Catholics? Well, no, I'm not a Catholic. And I'm not necessarily recommending Catholicism because I cite the Pope on something that I agree with. You know, I can agree with George Bush, you know, from time to time, or Bill Clinton from time to time, or somebody else, but I don't want you to think that I'm necessarily recommending them carte blanche. Now, keep in mind that the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember our website, georgegordon.org, or call the law school direct, 417-273-4967. 4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. We got to give that disclaimer every time because, you know, advertisers cringe, you know, as they listen to this program and they say, my God, we advertise Ivory Soap and that clown is over here telling you people about these crazy, and he's offending everybody out there, and we're really opposed to that. So I need to tell you that I'm not here to run down the advertisers or the sponsors or the radio station or the management. You know, some of these people are probably Catholics, Protestants, or Jews, and when I come on the air and I say, well, let me tell you where the bear does it, you know, it obviously offends some people. If you're not offended by the Law Hour, then you're not listening. All right, now the IRS is a Delaware corporation was the second item over here. The third, the IMF argument. Some contend that the Secretary of the Treasury is in reality a foreign agent under the control of the IMF. This argument has been rejected by the courts. Let's suppose for the sake of our discussion that that is 100% true. Let's suppose that the Secretary of the Treasury is an agent for the KGB. First of all, let me ask this. What has that got to do with you not filing your tax return? Assuming that your argument is true. You see, the judge looks at that and says, now let's see, the government is charging you with willful failure to file your tax return, and you come in here and you say that in your defense, the Secretary of the Treasury is a KGB agent. But you see, the Secretary of the Treasury isn't on trial here today. And your allegation may be 100% true, and maybe the Secretary of the Treasury should be impeached. Maybe he should be prosecuted for being a foreign agent. Maybe there's all these crimes being committed in the Treasury Department, but that's not the subject that we're here to talk about today. We're here to talk about you not filing your tax return. So, first of all, it's off point and out of context. Doesn't have any bearing on this case at all. It's like telling the judge, well, I don't think that you have made your sworn statement or filed your sworn statement with the Secretary of State. It's irrelevant. It's irrelevant. I'm sitting here as the judge. I've been installed as the judge, and if you want to have me removed, now, you may have me removed for cause, and not filing my sworn statement or sworn oath may be cause to have me removed as a judge, but as of today, I'm the judge. Like it or lump it. And just because the judge has been impeached or removed for cause doesn't mean that all the cases that he's decided in the years before are null and void. I don't have any bearing on. But from now on, we're going to have a new judge in here. Now, people have raised that argument. I've heard that argument raised. It's almost like saying, we're charging you with willful failure to file, and you look over at the prosecutor and you say, well, you didn't file your tax return either. Okay. Maybe the prosecutor didn't file his tax return. Maybe he's just as guilty as you are, and he's the pot calling the kettle black, but he's not on trial here today. You are. And you need to zero in on your defense, not on his prosecution. That's the bottom line to that story. Number four, non-resident aliens. Some people contend that we are, for tax purposes, non-resident aliens. Again, this improper argument has been correctly rejected by the courts. Now, I'm not citing the cases. This IMF argument has three cases that he cited. And if you want the citations on these cases, that is, the proof is in the pudding. You know, the old adage says in the Bible, you know, prove all things and hold fast that which is good. You ought to prove these statements that I'm making to you. But, you know, there's pages and pages of citations. And if I sit here and I say United States versus Rosnow, 977 Fed 2nd 3919, 413 8th Circuit 1992, you know, you can get those numbers down. They don't mean anything to you unless you can get them down because you want to go look at that case. And so that's why I suggested that you go to BCRAF's website, pull this article for yourself. If you're interested in any of these, hit a hot button and you say, God, I'd like to see some of those cases on the money issue. I'd like to see some of those cases on the IMF argument. I'd like to see this non-resident alien thing. Let's see how many cases on this non-resident alien have been decided. There's five there. Yeah, five. Five cases, all of them from the circuit courts. I might point out here that as we talk about income taxes, I remember I was pretty hot and heavy into income tax. I still am. I'm opposed to the income tax. I think that it's a regressive tax. I think that it sucks. But the income tax is not unlawful, illegal, unconstitutional, or in some other way deficient as a matter of law. And people who have income need to file income tax returns and pay income tax. Now, I recommend that you stop having income. I think income is bad for you. And I avoid income like AIDS, herpes, and VD. Now, you can't avoid all income. I mean, during the course of a year, you're going to have a little. Now, the government's pretty liberal. They're up to $7,200. And I just got word the other day that they raised it to $84. Now, don't quote me. You better call H&R Block to see what the filing minimum is. But the last time I saw some numbers, it was $7,200. Now, over the years, I've made it a point not to earn income in excess of the filing minimum. I try to avoid all the income that I possibly can. And I've had people ask me, how do you live? And I always tell them, I live very well. Thank you. And I think that you can live better without income than you can with income. Although most people, they look at me with a blank stare and they say, my God, I can't imagine how there could be a life without income. And I can understand that. Communists cannot understand life without income, because income is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto. But if you could get over communism and get back to republicanism. You know, we had a republican form of government here in the United States long before we had income. And people got along pretty well between 1787 and 1913. Now, it could well be that people are living better today than they did in 1890. I don't know. I wouldn't comment on that. I wasn't here in 1890. I can't tell you. But I'm here in 2005, and I used to have income from about 1950 until about 1978. I had a lot of income. And I lived my lifestyle from 1950, when I started delivering newspapers, until 1978, when I rescinded my Social Security and I stopped having income. And I can testify in the first person that from 1978 to 2005, I lived better without income than I did with income from 1950 to 78. So from 1979 through 2005, I lived better and I'm happier without income than I was from 1950 to 78 with it. That's just my testimonial. And you probably are sitting there saying, my God, I can't understand how this guy can live without income. I've been asked by government agents, how do you live without income? And I always tell them, very well. Thank you. Very well. Thank you. So tuck that one away in your heart. Now, number five, Larry B. Kraft cites the Form 1040 is really a codicil to a will. I've only heard that article, argument brought up one time. I had a guy who called it a codicil, and I said, what in the hell is a codicil? And he said, you're a law school teacher, and you don't know what a codicil is? I said, no, I don't know what a codicil is. And he said, well, it's an attachment to a will. And I thought to myself, and I was sitting there, I said, well, now, what does an amendment to a will going into probate have to do with income tax? I was just at a loss. So I asked him. And so he started to explain it, and I listened to his words. And there were a lot of words coming out of this guy's mouth. But I couldn't make any sense out of what was coming out of his mouth. It was like going to church. And you sit there, and you listen to this clown up there in the pulpit, and there's a lot of words coming out of his mouth, and you're trying to make sense out of what this guy is saying. And there's nothing sensible coming out of his mouth. Have you ever had that experience? You're listening to all these words. You understand what the guy's telling you. You understand the words. But you can't put his thoughts together and come up with a conclusion. And that's the way this guy was with this codicil. So I went and looked it up, and sure enough, a codicil is an amendment to a will. He was using this in an income tax circumstance, and he did. He went in and he argued this in federal court right here in Springfield, Missouri. I think it was Judge Clark, and Judge Clark threw his ass in jail. just like that, which is what I would have expected. And the argument was rejected in Ritchie versus Indiana Department of State Revenue. It's only cited one time, 634 Northeast 2nd, 1375, back in 1994. Now, after that, this guy used this. After it had already been ruled upon. Now, all this guy had to do was to look up codicil, C-O-D-I-C-I-L. And you can look this up on Find Law, and you'll find this case, which is called Ritchie versus Indiana Department of State Revenue, and you can read it. And if an Indiana court ruled against this guy in Indiana, you could just about bet that the court's going to rule against you where you're at, unless there is some real legal merit to it. Now, I wouldn't say, you know, coming right off the top of my head that it's got no legal merit. You have to do the research. I remember old Judge Clark one time, he really reprimanded me. I was in chambers one day, and I brought an action for declaratory judgment. And remember I told you early on that Larry B. Kraft got reprimanded by the courts, and I want to tell you that if a judge likes you, he might reprimand you. Kind of like your daddy did. Well, Judge Clark kind of liked me. And the reason I know that is that old Judge Clark used to take me back into chambers and tell me the answer to my riddles. You know, I'd come in there with some legal argument, and he'd take me back in there and say, well, did you research this out? Well, one time he asked me that question. He said, did you research this out? And I said, no. And he just tore into me, and he just ripped me up one side and down the other. He says, now listen, you're taking my time to rule on this case, and if you would have just researched this out on Lexis, you would have gotten the answer. You would have gotten the answer. And then he told me the answer to it. And I felt kind of stupid. Now, this Judge Clark was in his 70s. Hell, he might have been 80. I don't remember exactly how old he was when he died. He died here about three or four years ago. But this old Judge Clark, he's a pretty nice old guy. I really like Judge Clark. And sometimes he ruled for me, and sometimes he ruled against me. But when he ruled against me, he'd take me back in there, and he'd tell me the answer to the riddle. He said, well, have you thought about this being a discriminatory policy against a suspect classification of persons? I said, you know, Judge, it never crossed my mind. And he said, why don't you go check that out and then bring this case back again? See, he'd tell you the answer, and then you could go look up in the law, and you'd find out that, yeah, you know, this is a discriminatory policy against a suspect classification of persons. So I'm one of those suspect classifications of persons. I need to bring this in here as a discriminatory action, not as a tort claim. So the judge told me one time, he said, well, I'm going to rule against you because you're dead wrong here, but have you considered? Now, judges will do that when they... You know, unless you get rude and obnoxious with them, give them the finger or something like that. Many, many times I've had judges tell me the answers to my legal questions or legal inquiries, just privately, sometimes over lunch, you know, sometimes in chamber, sometimes in a written opinion. I've had written opinions. And the Idaho Supreme Court one time gave me the answer to a riddle in a case in their opinion. They said, if Gordon could prove that he owned the automobile in question, we would have a much different case before us. So there it is. The Supreme Court of Idaho, they weren't opposed to me. They ruled against me. I lost the case. But in the case, they said, now if Gordon could prove that he owned that automobile, we would have a much different case before us. I remember that very same line in McKinsey versus New York in 1914. We would have a much different case before us if. And so the issue that you brought up over here, you lose on. But if you bring up this other issue over here, which we're not going to tell you with specificity what it is, but you ought to be able to read between the lines and bring that back in here, you know, and we'll give that some consideration. And that's what you got to do, is you've got to come in here with something that's new, unique, that's never been tried before. Or if you want to win your case, the most logical thing to do is go find what the winners do and then follow what the winners do and avoid what the losers do. And that's what Larry Beecraft is doing here for us. He's telling you, here's what the losers did, and they lost. And if you go into court and you raise these same losing arguments, like this codicil to a will, you're going to lose. So forget this codicil argument here. And that's just another loser. Now, number six, filing 1099s against IRS agents. I had a guy do that to me one time. He filed a 1099 against me. He said that he paid me $121,000. Can you believe that? Now, that's a felony. I want to point out that you ought not to be writing 1099 forms and sending them out to people to vexatiously bring them into litigation with the IRS. And there's been a lot of patriots do that against judges. They file liens against judges and prosecutors and one thing and another. Those are just malicious, vindictive actions that don't have any merit whatsoever in law. Law is the code. Law is the rule by which we all live. We here in America drive on the right side of the road. Everybody does. Everybody in this country drives on the right side of the road. And when you're driving on the left side of the road and you hit somebody or cause an accident, you are guilty. You're wrong. You're going to have to pay those damages. And why is that? Well, we have a rule. And everybody follows that rule. And when you're driving down the road in this country at 80 miles an hour, and you look up in the up ahead of you there, and you see a car, and he's off to your left, just offset just a little bit off to your left. And he's up there maybe a half a mile or so. And he's traveling toward you at 60 miles an hour, and you're traveling toward him at 60 miles an hour. You people are approaching each other at 120 miles an hour. Now, that guy has the absolute utmost confidence that you are going to drive on the right side of the road. And you have the utmost confidence that he's going to drive on the right side of the road. And sure enough, when you meet and pass each other at 120 miles an hour, you're on the right side, he's on the right side, and between you there's maybe 2 feet, maybe 4 feet. 4 feet of space between you and him at 120 miles an hour, and you both pass. Isn't that marvelous? It's because we all follow that same rule of law. And what happens when somebody breaks the law, somebody doesn't follow the rule of law, he drives on the wrong side of the road, he doesn't stop at the stop sign, he doesn't follow the rules, an accident occurs and damages arise. You don't file your tax return, you don't pay your taxes, and the law requires you to file tax returns and pay your taxes. Now, I tell people all the time, so I don't file tax returns. I haven't since 78. But I'm always quick to point out I avoid income. I don't have any income, and if I do, I limit it to something less than what the government allows, which is, you know, over the years they keep raising it as inflation goes on. I remember when I started, I think it was $6,800 a year. Oh, no, it was less than $5,800 a year, and then it's been raising steadily ever since. And now it's up to, somebody said the other day, $8,400. But I follow the rules. I play the game by the rules. And here's what I tell my students. The guy that plays the game of law and wins most often is the guy that plays the game by the rules. You got to know how to play this game by the rules. Now, Larry Beecraft is suggesting to all of you out here that you learn how to play this game by the rules. And there's no rule that says that you can't raise a codicil to a will in your defense. But you should be advised that everybody that does that is going to lose that tax case. It is not a viable defense in a tax issue. And that's what this point is all about. And filing 1099s against IRS agents is malicious, and it can get you into trouble. One time, some asserted that when an agent of the government inflicted damage upon somebody, the proper response should be filing a Form 1099 against the agent because the agent was enriched by the damage so inflicted. Parties doing this went to jail. In United States versus Yagao, United States versus Kubal, and United States versus Dykstra, there's three cases. Of course, today we have essentially the same thing in the format of filing common law liens. More than enough people have gone to jail with such lunacy. And recently, Roger Elvick, who went to jail for doing this, has again incorporated into his redemption process the same scheme. So you've got straw men, and you've got redemption process, and UCC 1-207, all kinds of nonsensical legal tricks to play. Sometimes those legal tricks are illegal. And before you engage in some of these activities, you should get some good, competent legal advice. Either go to law school and train yourself, or two, train yourself on Find Law or in the law library, or three, go talk to an accountant or a CPA or to a tax attorney and ask them, you know, is this legal and can I do this? Now, when these guys like Roger Elvick and these gurus come along and they say, oh, no, Don't call the IRS. Don't go talk to an attorney. Don't talk to an accountant. Sounds to me like a Catholic saying, oh no, don't go to the Bible and read the Bible. Go to the priest and let him tell you. What's wrong with you reading it yourself out of the Bible? What's wrong with you going and getting the information yourself? What's wrong with you informing yourself before you get yourself into trouble? I know it's a wild new concept. But I got to hand it to Larry. He's taking the time, effort, and energy, and we just scratched the surface here. We're running out of time here, and I'm going to have to cut this off and take it up next time. But so far, we've covered six items over here. This is filing 1099s, a codicil to a will, the money issue. The IRS is a Delaware corporation, the IMF argument, and non-resident aliens. You've probably heard these arguments, and you've probably heard somebody talk about them. I've heard people stand up and tell you a story and cite cases and all this, and it's really great. I like to listen to it. I wish it were true. But then when I go check those cases out, or when I go look into the cases in opposition to these cases being cited, I find out that, hey, wait a minute, this guy's got his head up the wrong end of his anatomy. So Larry Beecraft took the time to look these up and cite the cases and say, now listen, don't do that, because if you do, you're going to go to jail. So if you want to make a statement, and you want to go to prison, and you want to show everybody that that you're standing four square for America and the red, white, and blue, you know, get after it. It's a choice that you have to make. But I can't see any real value in going to prison over an income tax issue over here. I can see a lot more value in staying out of prison, keeping your money, keeping your property, and not paying the income tax. And I'd like to help you do that. And we have a law school here, and we teach people how to do that. But we don't teach people to break the law or become tax protesters. What you do is you take the loopholes that are built into the law, and you capitalize on those loopholes. That's the common word that's used on the street, the loophole in the law. Find out what that loophole is, and then do what the winners do and avoid what the losers do. All right, we're out of time. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here again next time here on the Law Hour. Remember, you've been listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours. Just call the Law School and ask for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Okay, time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.